The Beginning of the Ramana Mantra by T.K. Sundarasaiah. Bhagavan never gave a mantra unsolicited. When asked, he sometimes approved of the use of one. He sometimes allowed the name Ramana to be used as a mantra, sometimes a single syllable I. However, he was insistent that the question, "Who am I?" is not a mantra. The mantra Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya fascinated me greatly in my early days. It so delighted me that I constantly saw Sri Krishna, Vasudeva, in my mind's eye. I had a premonition, footnote, which proved unjustified, because he passed away at the age of 68. See Ashram Bulletin. I had a premonition that this body of mine would pass away in its 40th year, and I wanted to have a vision of the Lord before that time. I fasted and practiced devotion to Krishna Vasudeva incessantly. I took great delight in reading the Bhagavad Gita and the Bhagavata. Then when I read the Gita, I regard the Jnani as my own self, unquote. I was overjoyed. I reflected, when I have here Bhagavan Sri Ramana, who is Vasudeva's own self, why should I worship Vasudeva separately? All this was in my early days before settling down at Sri Bhagavan's ashram. I wanted one mantra, one scripture, and one form of worship, so that there might be no conflict of loyalties. Sri Ramana Paramatma was obviously the god to worship. His writings were the gospel. And as for the mantra, if it struck me that Om Namo Bhagavate Sri Ramanaya was an exact parallel of the one I had used formerly. I counted the letters and found that it also contained 12 Sanskrit letters. I told Bhagavan and he gave his approval. Intellectuals may laugh at this, and ask why I needed a mantra when the ocean of bliss was there before me. I confess that I was drawn to the traditional method of bhakti practice. Bhagavan has revealed his true nature as the all-witness. Yet there is also the saying that a dvaita must be only in the attitude of mind and never in outer action. That is how this mantra first came to be approved. Climbing Arunachala by Satya Narayana Tendon. Tendon is a Sindhi
Tendon is Sindhi.
Probably from Mumbai or
something.
Yeah.
Right? What is Sindhi?
They're from a place with Pakistan, Sindhi. Part of Pakistan. Yeah, and Sindhi. During the partition, most of them left. You know, during, right?
Mm-hmm. The partition.
And they came like penniless, actually, mm-hmm. most of them.
Yeah.
But they're businessmen and they don't do very well. Yeah. Yeah, they're very good.
They're very well-to-do.
Hard-working businessmen. They all did very well in Mumbai.
Oh. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Like Prames.
Yeah.
Father Vazarani. Alin Chand, the name was. Very devoted, quiet person. When I was at the ashram in April 1964, a desire to climb to the top of Arunachala arose in me. But as my wife was suffering from arthritis and taking injections every second day, it did not seem possible. I could not leave her alone for the day, especially as she spoke neither Tamil nor English. However, the following night, Bhagavan appeared to me in a dream and reminded me to climb to the top. I still could not decide. But a few days later, my wife herself urged me to, saying that she would wait at the ashram till I got back. I told Sundaresha Iyer, and with the help of the postmaster, Raja Iyer, he arranged for two people to go with me early next morning. We set out at about 5 on the morning of April 17th and reached Gandhashram by about 5:30. It was about 8:30 when we got to the peak after climbing over rocks, stony paths, and dry water courses. At several places, I had to sit and rest for some minutes as the climb had exhausted me. Though I had climbed mountains of 10 and 12,000 feet in my youth, at 63 I found even Arunachala's 2,000 feet tiring. 2,600. Like a half a mile high.
This is right on at the top?
In Fremont, you know where I go often there. There's a called Mission Peak. It, you know, it's part, you know, it's all a park. You know, so many people climb that peak exactly the same height, 20. And from some distance, it looks exactly like Arunachala. Swami lived right near the foot of that for some time. Once or twice, I felt tempted to bow down respectfully to the Lord at the summit from where I stood and return. But when I gazed up in reverence, I saw Bhagavan standing on the summit, smiling as if to encourage me not to lose heart, but to climb. The last bit was especially exhausting, and when at last I reached the peak, I was gasping like a buffalo yoked to a heavy load. All through the climb, I had been inwardly chanting Arunachala Shiva. But at that moment, the chanting spontaneously stopped. The oval-shaped rock by the side of which I stood was stained black from the melted ghee of the beacon fire lit there annually on Kartikeya Deepam Day. Although the sun was by now well up in the sky, a cool and pleasant breeze was blowing. Merged in the bliss of sacred Arunachala, I suddenly felt that a crevice had opened before me and I sank down into it. How far I did not know. After some time I found myself back on the summit with nothing on but a loincloth. And before me stood Bhagavan. He turned and walked westward, and I after him. How he could walk from summit to summit as though over a smooth surface, and I follow him, was a mystery to me. And yet, so it was. While thus walking, I suddenly saw, instead of Bhagavan, a huge column of some milky white substance rising up before me. I walked up to it and became merged in it, losing my identity. When the sun had risen higher and the guides were anxious to return, we started back. The return was more tiring than the ascent. I could not walk barefoot as the stones had now become too hot in the fierce sun. And with shoes on, I slipped on the smooth rocks. I got back to Skandashram at about noon, but was too exhausted to undertake the further short walk to the ashram. So I rested there for about 3 hours, arriving back at the ashram at about 4 PM. And there I found my wife and Sri Sundaresha Iyer waiting anxiously for me. I treasure this experience as a wonderful manifestation of Bhagavan's grace. Did you go to the top? What was that? Oh, I only went one time in 1993.
You went up, Arpa, did you go?
No. Mm. I didn't know the lift up.
Yeah.
It never occurred to me to go to the top for some reason.
Yeah. The Power of Shakti Pat by Swami Muktananda. We already carried an article about Swami Nityananda in our June issue, in our issue of April 1965. However, the following article by a Swami whom many regard as his successor, so much keeping with the theme of the present issue, that we offer no apologies for including this also. This world, this universe, this Brahmananda, described variedly as real and existent, unreal and non-existent, and even paradoxically as both real and unreal, existent and non-existent, teases man out of the thought and remains a question of questions. What indeed is this macrocosm? The six systems of Indian philosophy expound it differently. The Vedanta designates it as an unsubstantial pageant and an optical illusion on the analogy of a rope mistaken for a serpent. Modern science takes it as materially composed of atoms and electrons. Each of thus perceives the world from his own circumscribed view and projects its image to suit his limited perception. Whatever it is, the world is undoubtedly a miracle of a phenomenon, however incomprehensible it may appear. There's no gainsaying the truth that its creator has fashioned it with flawless artistry and indescribable efficiency. It needs no more than a modicum of thought to ask whence there could have been thought light and heat without the sun, coolness of the night without the moon, life without wind, quenching of thirst without water, the very existence of beings without the earth's fertility sprouting into corn, fruits, flowers, vegetation, and medicinal plants. Where would beauty be found if not in the majestic mountains, sparkling streams, ever-flowing rivers, shady trees, lovely creepers, fragrant flowers, and the ever-shifting kaleidoscope of colors over the earth and heaven? Birds and beasts add as much to this beauty as the landscape. All this leads to its particular charm, strikes terror and evokes sense of unspeakable awe and grandeur. In its totality, this world of sattva, rajas, tamas, instinct with sat-chit-ananda, no one stands exposed in a bewildering variety of forms. Even among men, there is an intriguing and surprisingly variety. Well, this is going to be a long article. Very long article. You know, this Muktananda, he all over New York City, you used to see pictures of him. Okay. Posters. Be with Baba. And he was very popular in the 80s, yeah.
He passed away.
Oh, yeah. But you had this Guru Mai was his successor. You have heard of her?
No. Her name begins with a Chipala.
Right.
She wears the red hat.
Yeah.
I read one of his books, Meditate. Very beautifully written.
His Muktananda.
Yeah. She's upstate somewhere, right?
Yeah. They had a big ashram there.
Yeah.
She's very popular.
She was relatively young, wasn't she?
Because he gave, it was a brother and a sister.
Uh-huh.
And they were the children of one of his devotees. So he gave everything over to them,
right.
A brother and sister. But they broke away from each other.
Oh, yeah. And they've started their own ashram?
Well, the sister took over everything and the brother got kicked out. But he remained a Swami or something.
Okay.
This is so hard.
I know.
What?
This thing is so hard. It's so hard.
Yeah.
You know about miracle. Swami Muktana is like 5 pages. But he's going to talk about Shaktipat, that's a big thing.
He
just has a feather.
Yeah. Anyway.
What's the Shaktipat?
Olivia said it curled her fingernails.
And I had some of those feathers. That'll happen to him.
It's a right?
Give past Shaktipat. The person would have some visit or something.
Oh, yeah.
Sai Baba and his followers by Sai Das. To his followers, Sai Baba is God, of course. God can take other forms as well. He wouldn't be a God if he couldn't. He can appear as Rama or Christ or Ramana. But for Saya Bhakta, Saya Baba is all sufficient. He was a peculiar master. He did not give his followers a mantra to repeat. He did not give initiation in the ordinary way. Quote, my guru never taught me any mantras, so how shall I blow any into your ear? He demanded only wholehearted concentration on the guru so that the love of the guru can unite with your love and raise you up. Trust in the Guru fully. That is the only sadhana. Look at me wholeheartedly, and I in turn will look at you wholeheartedly. Neither practice nor scripture is necessary. Have faith and confidence in your Guru. As an aspirant should be immersed in love for the Guru like a fish in the water, which it cannot leave without dying. Unquote. He was not an intellectual. He did not write books. He did not even encourage his followers to read books. People think that they will find Brahma, God, in books. But instead they find Brahma, confusion. He did not teach by lectures, but by miracles. All kinds of miracles happened. Originally Orthodox Brahmin standing outside the Shirdi mosque and looking in told his companions that he would never bow down to a guru who lived in a mosque. Suddenly he saw Sai Baba in the form of his own guru and bowed down. Sai Baba did not explain that the guru is one in whatever form or religion he may appear, he showed it. A woman was preparing a meal for him in her own home and drove away a hungry dog that tried to steal some of it. When she took it to him later, he said, no, you drove me away when I wanted it, so now I won't eat it. He didn't have to say, inasmuch as you do it to one of the least of these, you do it also to me. That's what Jesus said. He showed it. His miracles did not end with his physical body. That died far back in 1918. But he continued just the same to appear to devotees, save them from accidents, cure them when ill, comfort them in distress, bring relief in misfortune, not only to devotees, but to many others also, who had never before heard of him. As a result of this, his following now is far larger than at his death, and is growing constantly. The tradition of a great master continues among his followers. Look at Ramana Maharshi. He was an intellectual, and see what intellectual articles are written in the mountain path. Sai Baba followers are mostly not intellectuals, just as he was not, and very few of them write books and articles. But it is surprising how many of them work miracles. It is a tradition descended from their master. It just comes to them. It is invidious to mention some without others, and I do it with apologies both to those I mention, to those I do not. It is hard to live in India, for instance, without hearing of the astonishing miracles performed by Sri Satya Sai Baba, who was held by his followers to be an incarnation of Sai Baba. Then there is the quiet, unassuming Bashir Baba, who was of a Muslim family and, like Sai Baba himself, rigid the religions. In a less spectacular way, he also uses powers. There is Sri Swami Keshavaya, whose house is not in the far off out suburb of Madras, is thronged on Thursday evening by people who come to hear from him whether their plans will mature or their hopes be fulfilled. You heard of here? You heard, Malini, you heard of this? Keshavaya?
Keshav.
Oh, Keshavaya. Swami Keshavaya lived near Madras. There's a simple lady devotee whose gold medallion of Sai Baba rises up in the air in front of her when she intercedes with Sai Baba for supplicants. The common feature in these and other cases is that they are not powers that have been acquired by tapas, as is common with Hindu swamis and sadhus, but that have just come naturally by the grace of Sai Baba. Something of his tradition of pouring out love and guidance on his followers through miracles has descended on his lieutenants also. And there is the same lack of formality. You do not have to be ordained as his lieutenant. The selection is made informally by the outpouring of his grace on those he chooses. Some Saya Bhaktas hold that efforts should be made to make Sai Baba widely known and revered throughout the world, as he is in India. My own opinion is that that is up to Sai Baba. Even if we write books and articles about him, will it make him widely known? Arthur Osborne's excellent book, The Incredible Sai Baba, has been published by Ryder and Company in London. But still we hear of no great Sai following in England. Perhaps the people in Western countries have enough roads to God and do not need this one. They have Christianity and Zen. Is it up to Sai Baba? He could easily raise up a following of followers in Western countries to perform miracles that would shake the newspapers by the ears and make the scientists scratch their heads. There would be plenty of followers then, and the demands for articles. Meanwhile, in India, the Sai following is not only strong, but growing. It advertises little, but what keeps it vigorous is the love and power of Sai Baba flowing through it. Quote from Bhagavan Sri Ramana Maharshi, public speeches, outer activity, and material help are all outweighed by the silence of the Mahatmas. They accomplish more than others.
Public speeches? One can give any speech.
they talked. Outside Yourself by Claire Cameron. Have you ever known what it feels like to be literally outside yourself? You are perhaps reading in bed, and your glance falls on your clothes lying on the chair, and with a shock you realize they don't belong to you, but only to something that houses you. Your head turns to survey the books on the bedside table. How dead they seem. Surely they have nothing to teach you. A train goes by in the distance, but you hear it from another dimension. Outside, the moonlight is beautiful, and still over the trees in the garden. But how opaque it seems, as if you are looking through hard, thick lenses that fix it in time. To recover your identity, you recall the humdrum events of the day. How very slowly everything has happened, even though at the time you seem too busy to think. Slow, slow, slow. Yes, everything is slowed down in that, in what is erroneously called life. Even as everything is seen through a glass darkly. What's a darkly?
Through a glass darkly, you see only dark images. You don't see it shining.
But here and now, outside yourself, the speed of light, the dazzling clarity of light, the infinity of it all, and the unity of it all, where all imagined barriers are gone, the sense of weightlessness now, so that one can and does walk on air. Walk? No, run, fly, with the speed of light, for you are the light. Freedom? Encased in our flesh? Weighed down by illusions? With a heavy darkness between ourselves and our fellow creatures throughout creation? We have never known it. Wisdom? We have glimpsed it as men look up through bars above their heads to the sunlight. Love? Oh, what keeps us back from loving? When seen in this light, all men and all women, all living things are endearing and lovable and crying out for the recognition and response of love. Is it in the room I write? Who writes? I am not here. A hand guides the pen. But who or what dictates the words which are so distressingly limited and inflexible, letting through only glimpses, gleams, invoking but faint echoes? Words are so separate from one another, so slow, mere expediencies. In their millions, they are like grass blades, but if you saw them truly, you would know they are plucked from the meadows of heaven. They are like raindrops. But if you were indeed the drop, you would know it was part of the waters of life. Oh, press me not back into my body, I who am the universe. Dull, not the vision that overflowed the confines of the mind. Break my heart of stone, if only I may love. Is this what it feels like to die? To die? This is to be born. I died when I emerged from my mother's womb. How strange it is to be born when one is still in and with the body, but how easily parted from it. Is the flesh then but gossamer when the spirit illumines it? What is a gossamer?
Gossamer is like a web, like a gossamer web. Yeah.
Now I know that death, as we have never known it, is life. And life, as we know it, is death. Ah, thou, in whom we move and have our being and know it not.
That's nice.
Prayer and Power by Kornila Bhagavati. Around man and unknown to himself lies the great unflowing, inflowing, interpenetrating ocean of life. Above him shines the glory of the stars, and round him gleams in the light of the seas and forests. Within him it radiates in the secret fastness of the human heart. Ever living, ever breathing, eternal, it is a tremendous ocean of light. This is the divine love of the cosmos. This is the creator of all universes. This is the substance from which all that was made was made. This is the sacred word. Nearer than touch, closer than his own hand, forever and always, indestructibly there. Yet in the midst of it all stands man blinded by the darkness his own ego has projected into this great light of eternal life. Unknowing of the infinite glory of which he has always been and shall always remain, a living part. How many saints and seers and mystics and illumined souls and world teachers have come to try to bring to man this revelation? How many sacred books have been written? How many dedicated lives have been lived? But so great has been man's immersion in his separate ego and his body that this revelation could not be passed on. It still remains today the greatest mystery of all. A divine discontent seizes some men at a certain period of their lives, and they, like the Buddha, go off seeking the answer to eternal questions. They may spend their lives reading the spiritual teaching of all time and all peoples. They may enter a monastic order or seek an ashram or remain in their own household, but the secret they search for is ever the same. At some point, like the smallest child, they must look up and look beyond themselves. They must surrender their ego, their body, their possessions, their ambitions, their desires, their actions, and return to the infinite as they came. As a child sustained and nourished and created by love alone. This recognition of God and surrender to God brings with it humility, reverence, faith, prayer, selflessness, harmlessness, all-encompassing love, and is the mother of all virtues. Dazed man falls on his knees, blinded by the infinite vision of a love beyond all magnitude, of which he is a conscious breathing part. Not my will, but thine becomes his constant prayer. His temporal self dies, and the eternal self is revealed. At this moment, the words of the Christ sound forth, "My peace I bring you. Not as the world gives, I give to you." The peace of God which passeth all understanding. When man receives this peace, he knows that he has love. What once began as the path of prayer ends with the receiving of a revelation in which the ultimate power of all is born. The power to share with all participation in the divine. Even if the illumined man said not a word, his being pregnant with God's ocean of life, would move beyond time and space to infuse the hearts of men. Something of his divinity would pass into them, quickening their own hearts to return to the infinite. Not by leaving the world, but by transmuting every word and act with cosmic consciousness. There's an article here, Fire Walking in South India.
Oh, yeah.
You know, they do it in Arunachala Temple every year. They've been doing it for centuries. I mean, it's like some tradition. They have it.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, yeah.
They do it in there.
The Murugan devotees.
Yeah.
They have that.
Have you seen it?
They are doing it in Singapore, Malaysia.
So how do they do it? Someone was going around.
They do it in Singapore, Malaysia, yes, everywhere.
She filmed it.
Yeah,
Tamil Nadu.
It's a tribal. It's a tradition,
actually.
So they psych themselves up first or something.
Oh, yeah, they go into a trance.
Yeah.
So someone.
Not only that, they put the thing here, spear.
Do they do that? Do they do that?
They'll be bleeding, but they don't.
No, they all don't do that. Even someone was going, some American learned it. He was going around, he was going to teach us in Nova Scotia Ashram how to do it.
I can see Margo doing that.
So she filmed it.
They psych it up. Yeah.
If they go into fasting for 13 days
They fast for 13 days before.
And then they put coal. So what happens is they run, actually they run very fast, and at the end of the run, there's a pit of water. Full of water, so they go into that. Oh. So they're running very fast, and they're fanning the with those palm leaves, they're fanning to make it glow. So it looks like, I think in Tamil it's called flowers.
Uh-huh.
In the embers.
The
festival is translated as flowers or something.
Blossoms. Or...
Yeah. So I don't know. I filmed this Nepali lady who would put a bow in.
Brahmins don't have the...
They're the tribal. They're tribal.
They can't tolerate pain.
But it's not painful. They don't get burnt.
No,
they don't get burnt. It's not painful. They have some technique.
Yeah, that's why they are not warriors. They cannot tolerate pain.
Brahmins.
Sattvic food, right?
Yeah. Everyone has a purpose.
Yeah.
Well, here I'll just read the beginning here.
They do. It's a tradition. And the thing in Singapore, Malaysia, and all, it goes in with great vigor, even Thailand.
Puri say Murugesha Mudaliar.
Yeah, Murugan, the Muruga devotee is there.
Fire walking is still a regular event in Tiruvannamalai and other South Indian towns. Usually a trench is filled with burning charcoal, and over this, the practicants walk, coming to the end unscathed. The ceremony is usually held under the auspices of a temple. Some of these hold it once a year, while others maintain a regular ritualistic chanting of the Mahabharata and celebrate the fire walking each time the entire work is brought to an end. Those who participate are usually ordinary householders, not sadhus or sannyasins. They are largely composed of non-Brahmins. In some cases, they are given a particular mantra to recite for protection. But there are also cases where they are protected simply by faith in God or goddess of the temple. Usually they fast for some days beforehand, not in the sense of abstaining completely from food and drink, but observing strictly regulated and very abstemious diet.
Abstemious
diet. Always they have to maintain an attitude of purity and devotion. One interesting thing about these fire walking ceremonies is how little they are publicized. For instance, scarcely anyone from Shiraman Ashramam visits them. Visitors here seldom even know that they occur. This reticence is in a way a guarantee of their genuineness. It shows that they are not staged to impress the audience. There is practically no audience for them to impress, only the usual local people. They have a pretty big article.